It is Monday, October the 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, missing Saudi journalist and potential impact on Saudi Arabia.
Jamal Khashoggi puts a face and a human story with a man about to get married to behavior that the Saudis are engaged in around the world.
Election shock in Germany, Korean diplomacy, and new thoughts about sanctions on Pyongyang.
Because of Kim Jong-un's actions over the past year of not carrying out any tests, that perhaps it's time to revisit the sanctions and either make exemptions or relax them.
Also ahead, a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Two leading U.S. senators from President Trump's Republican Party are threatening tough punitive action by Congress against Saudi Arabia, including a possible halt of military sales if missing journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. AP's Ben Thomas has the story.
We do that, we're really hurting our country.
President Trump says he will take action if Saudi Arabia is behind Jamal Khashoggi's disappearance. But he told reporters over the weekend arms sales mean too much to the American economy. Senator Marco Rubio sees it differently. He tells CBS's Face the Nation, it's not about money.
There's not enough money in the world for us to buy back our credibility on human rights. If we do not move forward and take swift action on this.
On ABC's This Week, fellow Republican Jeff Flake says right now the Saudis are offering no credible explanation for why Khashoggi was never seen leaving the Saudi consulate.
I wouldn't be surprised to hear different explanations coming out of the Saudi government very soon. Explanations that, frankly, won't make much sense.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
And at the White House, the economic advisor Larry Kudlow, appearing on Fox News Sunday, said everyone should take heed of what President Trump has warned regarding the Khashoggi situation.
As in every case, when the president speaks, when the president warns, people should take him at his word. Obviously, he is very, very serious. I'm not going to get ahead of the curve. He'll decide what the appropriate actions are.
And for some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Cecile Shea, a non-resident senior fellow on global security and diplomacy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
Saudi Arabia has been engaged in behavior for decades that is, first of all, harmful to U.S. national security interests, and secondly, really in exact opposition of the values that the U.S. has always espoused and encouraged around the world. Saudi Arabia has been supporting a extremist form of Salafism, Salafi Sunniism, that led to the rise of Al-Qaeda, that has led to far more anti-Western terrorism than anything that Iran has ever done, which is not to excuse Iran. But we have to remember that the far-right Sunni Wahhabist movement is supported by Saudi Arabia and has been for many decades. Secondly, Saudi Arabia has, throughout its history, engaged in human rights policies and abuses against its own people and against people in other countries that, had they not been the world's major oil exporting power, would have earned them massive sanctions from the United States. But like with their behavior in terms of exporting Islamist extremism, the human rights problems both inside and outside the country have not earned them a lot of international sanctions because they do export oil. Similarly, the human rights crisis in Yemen, to which Saudi Arabia has contributed, also has met with a fairly mute response from around the world. But now you have the apparent murder of Mr. Khashoggi. We're waiting for more definitive proof. And this has garnered people's attention. You know, in the same way that the story of Anne Frank is easier to understand than hearing about 6 million Jews being murdered in the Holocaust, Jamal Khashoggi puts a face and a human story with a man about to get married to behavior that the Saudis are engaged in around the world. What is different for Saudi Arabia this time than previous decades is, first and foremost, the U.S. is far more oil independent than we have been in the past. And I think Saudi Arabia recognizes that. Because of fracking and because of the availability of Canadian energy, we still are reliant on Middle East oil, to be sure, but we are far less reliant on it than we were, say, during the 1970s, during the two oil embargoes.
Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud is apparently trying to seek a diplomatic solution to this matter. He stressed the strength of Saudi-Turkish ties in a phone call with President Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey. Is this an encouraging sign?
Yeah, well, what happened today, of course, is the Saudi stock market fell pretty precipitously. It made up some of the losses at the end. But it's a reminder to the Saudis that they are somewhat vulnerable, perhaps more vulnerable than they were in the 70s. And by the way, it's also not clear that their Gulf state, that their OPEC oil allies would all join in any kind of a boycott, oil boycott against the West or against the United States. So he realizes that he's in a precipitous situation. And Turkish government has made noises to the effect that they are willing to engage in a joint investigation of what happened. So we'll see. Clearly, the president would like to not have to sanction Saudi Arabia. He intends, apparently, for the arms sales to go through, although I believe there's still a way for Congress to block those. So we'll see what happens. The other big question is whether the crown prince's title as crown prince is going to be in danger after that, because there have to be a lot of people at the senior levels of the Saudi royal family who are very unhappy with this incident.
Iran must be looking on this with some joy.
Iran looks at this with a certain amount of satisfaction for two reasons. One is just that Saudi Arabia is its competitor. Saudi Arabia is the center of the export of Sunni extremism. Iran is the center of the export of Shiite extremism. So seeing its competitor and even some might say enemy in this much trouble around the world is going to be good for, is going to make the Iranian government feel a certain amount of relief. Secondly, this means that the world is going to need Iranian oil if indeed Saudi Arabia decides to cut back on its exports or to engage in some type of embargo against the West. And that would really put pressure on the European countries and on certain companies not to abide by the U.S. terms of the Iran Sanctions Act, and in other words, to go ahead and continue buying oil from Iran, which is what they would like to do anyway.
If foul play was determined, would this alter U.S.-Saudi relations?
Whether this will alter U.S.-Saudi relations when none of the other abuses by Saudi Arabia throughout its history have really altered U.S.-Saudi relations is an interesting question. And sometimes small incidents in history have a big impact. The biggest question that we're going to need to watch is whether this somehow lessens the power of the crown prince inside the royal family and inside the government of Saudi Arabia. If for some reason he is not able to ascend to the throne because of this, then that could alter a great deal of things. But it's really a little bit too early to make any kind of prognosis on that question.
Cecile Shea is a non-resident senior fellow on global security and diplomacy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. She was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. North and South Korea are holding high-level talks today to discuss engagement amid a global diplomatic push to resolve the nuclear standoff with the North. VOA correspondent Steve Miller is in Seoul and speaks with my colleague Lori London about the meeting.
Yes, actually, they're slated to begin in just a little bit here on Monday in Panmunjom, which is the truce village in the DMZ, separating between the two countries. On the south side, we have Unification Minister Cho Myung-gwan, and on the north side, we have his counterpart, Ri Sung-gwan, who is the chairman of the Committee for the Peaceful Reunification of the Country. And the purpose of this meeting is really to follow up on the outcomes of the Pyongyang summit that was held in September to try and implement some of the inter-Korean agreements that the two countries laid out in that declaration.
What do they hope to achieve at this meeting? Is this sort of a precursor to meetings between the leaders and possibly President Trump as well?
Well, not so much President Trump and Kim Jong-un. Those are mainly the discussions taking place between Pompeo and counterparts in Pyongyang. However, it is expected that Kim Jong-un will come to Seoul sometime, possibly before the end of the year, and that may be part of these discussions, because really what they're trying to hash out here are a number of these inter-Korean agreements. So they talked about at the summit reopening the Kaesong Industrial Complex, which was this joint operated industrial complex in North Korea that's been shuttered for a few years, reopening the Mount Kumjung tourist area that was jointly operated for a number of years. But some of the other key things they're going to discuss, presumably today, according to readouts from the Unification Ministry, are how to utilize the Red Cross to facilitate video chats between separated families and possibly holding family reunions in the future, as well as one of the more interesting things that came out of the summit is connecting roads and railways along the east and west coasts to try and facilitate some movement between the two countries. Now, analysts will say that, you know, a lot of these projects run afoul of both UN and U.S. sanctions, so it's unclear what can actually be done moving forward. But these may just be planning steps to see what can be done if and when those sanctions are relaxed.
So are all parties, particularly the UN, are they all in agreement that this is a good route to take and this would be something that's acceptable?
Well, we take a look at the UN sanctions. They were put in place because of the testing, because of the ballistic missile activity that North Korea was undertaking over the past few years. Now, South Korean President Moon Jae-in is starting to make the case, along with Russia and China, that because of Kim Jong-un's actions over the past year of not carrying out any tests, that perhaps it's time to revisit the sanctions and either make exemptions or relax them. Now, last week in Seoul, we had a World Knowledge Forum that was attended by former Ambassador Hill, former National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, and a lot of the experts, in addition to those I just mentioned, were cautiously optimistic about what was taking place in North Korea. They more or less said that, yes, there hasn't been any testing over the past year, but they also haven't seen a lot of activity in North Korea that wasn't easily reversible by the government in terms of their test facilities or what they could do. So they really weren't sure what the best course of action moving forward was, because right now the sanctions are the one piece of leverage left that the United Nations and the United States has in terms of preventing North Korea to pursue a course of nuclearization on the peninsula. But other analysts that were also here said that, you know, perhaps a staged approach is the best way to move forward. So instead of the old line of North Korea must completely denuclearize before sanctions are lifted, perhaps it's going to be tougher to keep those sanctions in place with China and Russia and even South Korea calling for a relaxation of those measures. And perhaps a staged approach, an action for action, where North Korea does something in good faith and then those sanctions are relaxed, would be a more pragmatic approach. But it all comes out to see what happens. All eyes really are on this second summit that's being proposed between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to see what, if any, really concrete measures come out of that. Pretty much all analysts are really in unison saying that the second summit needs to have some kind of concrete measures come out of it versus just the overall platitudes and broad statement that we've seen in the past.
That is VOA correspondent Steve Miller in Seoul speaking with VOA's Lori London.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservative allies lost their absolute majority in Bavaria's state parliament. It was by a wide margin in a regional election on Sunday, a result that could cause more turbulence within the national government. The Christian Social Union took 37.2% of the vote, down from 47.7% 5 years ago It was the party's worst performance since 1950 in a state vote in Bavaria, which has traditionally it's dominated. We asked our MIT University scholar Benoit Capmark what is at play here.
What is at play here is a populist revolt against traditionalism, the traditional parties that we're seeing in Bavaria that we have been seeing in other European countries as well, albeit this at the regional level. So the traditional base, which has been so vital to German politics for so long, and the CSU-CDU coalition being possibly threatened in terms of the broader German framework. So we are seeing gains being made by the parties that several years ago would not have imagined gaining as much as they have.
It was a precipitous drop for the Social Democrats, which have been one of the post-war Germany's biggest parties, and the up-and-coming Greens Party coming in second in Bavaria, followed by the far-right Alternative for Germany Party.
Yes, this is a very typical sort of development that's happening at the moment, because many voters, traditional voters, for example, for the CSU, would have been, for example, keen to see policies, be it in response to take a firmer line about immigration, because we have to remember that Bavaria was one of the states within Germany that was receiving most refugees and has been bearing the brunt of that. The result has been, of course, trying to find a policy to placate voters on the one hand, dealing with immigration, but on the other hand, also a more humane policy on the other. So the result is that people have been voting, depending on how they feel about how harsh, firm, or humanitarian the policies should be, to either the far-right Alternative für Deutschland or, the Greens.
We also asked if this is the beginning of the end for the four-term Merkel era in Germany.
Well, this may be the first unraveling of it because, of course, it starts in Bavaria, which is the home base there, and it may well, of course, affect the broader coalition. Now, it's one of the things to keep in mind is that in Germany, generally speaking, of course, in the fourth term, the chancellor will suffer, as happened, of course, with Helmut Kohl. We've seen it before, and we are to, you know, let's face it, we have to expect that a lot of rust has probably set in the system. Merkel is a very canny politician and a survivor, but it's very clear that the arrangements that had to be brokered some months ago seem to be unraveling at the local level.
Many observers have been predicting the major issue for the election would be migration, with numerous Germans opposed to the levels of immigration that have been happening, and many others in favor of helping people escape strife at their homelands for a better life in Germany. Dr. Capmark said immigration was at play in the election, as was the populist push, and on whether all of this might affect Germany's standing with the European Union, he says it is affecting the landscape for the EU. Benoit Capmark is a senior lecturer in the School of Global, Urban, and Social Studies at Australia's RMIT University. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
On August 21, 2017, a total solar eclipse followed a northwest to southeast path across the United States. A number of researchers from various scientific disciplines used the solar eclipse to conduct experiments. Researchers at the University of Missouri put together a group of citizen scientists along with elementary students and their teachers to study how a solar eclipse affects bees. 16 acoustic monitoring stations were placed along the total eclipse path in Oregon, Idaho, and Missouri. The monitoring stations were placed in locations where bees would congregate, such as flower patches. As the total eclipse made its way over each monitoring station, the researchers listened for the sound of bees buzzing, or as they found out, not buzzing. During the periods of totality, the bees took a break from their daily routines. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Guess what? It's time now for a little something from the world of music.
About time? Well, before you do anything rash,
did this. Everybody plays the fool sometimes. There's no exception to the rule.
The main ingredient is an American soul and R&B group best known for the 1972 hit song, Everybody Plays the Fool. The group was formed in New York City in 1964 as a trio called the Poets, composed of lead singer Don McPherson, Luther Simmons, and Panama-born Tony Sylvester. And in 1968, after a couple of singles, they changed their name to the main ingredient.
Than any ocean, it clouds your mind with emotion. Everybody plays the fool sometimes. There's no exception.
McPherson, who had been suddenly taken ill with leukemia, died unexpectedly, and stunned Tony Sylvester and Luther Simmons regrouped with new lead singer Cuba Gooding Sr., who had served as a backup vocalist on some of their previous recordings. The Gooding era began auspiciously with many hits, including the 1974 chart topper, Just Don't Want to Be Lonely.
Hey, say, wait a minute. Where you going with that suitcase? Hey, wait a minute, listen. All right, well, you don't have to answer. Just listen. I don't mind when you say that you're going away. I just don't want to be lonely. And I don't care if we share today. I just don't want to be lonely. I'd rather be loved and needed, depended on to give a love I can't give when you're gone. When you're gone, I just don't want to be lonely. I'd rather be loved. I don't mind if the tide sets the sun to the moon. I just don't wanna be lonely.
In 1975, Tony Sylvester had other ambitions. He released a solo album and left the group. Sylvester was replaced by Carl Tompkins, and Gooding departed for a solo career in 1977. Well, Gooding, Sylvester, and Simmons reunited as the main ingredient in 1979. The trio reunited again in 1986, but their single Do Me Right flopped, and Simmons returned to his day job. Sylvester and Simmons reformed the main ingredient in 1999 with new lead singer Carlton Blount. They released the hit I Love You in 2001. If I write a letter, Sylvester died after a six-year struggle with multiple myeloma in 2006 at the age of 65, and original member Luther Simmons retired shortly thereafter. And Cuba Gooding Sr. was found dead in his car in 2017. Well, the current lineup of the group, out entertaining people everywhere, consists of Jeremy Jackson and Stanley Alston. I was just thinking about it the other day. I must have 30 or 40 of their songs on my playlist. Great, the main ingredient. Love them. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. The latest world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. How about that, huh? Here's some more from the main ingredient.
That when I look into your eyes, I wanna say I love you. Yes, I wanna say I need you.
Explain this thing that I have for you. I could write it down on paper. I can even try to sing it in a song. But you'll never fully understand just how I feel.
I wanna say I love you.
This is Today in History. On October 15, 1529, Muslim forces under Commander Suleiman the Magnificent ended their siege of the heavily fortified Austrian city of Vienna. This marked the high water mark of the advance of the Ottoman Empire into Central Europe. On this date in 1815, French Emperor Napoleon began his exile on the British-held South Atlantic island of St. Helena. He was sent there after his defeat at Waterloo. Napoleon would remain on the island until his death in May of 1821. In 1894, French Captain Alfred Dreyfus, the highest-ranking Jewish officer in the French army, was arrested and charged with espionage and imprisoned on Devil's Island near French Guiana. The case rested on questionable evidence and was reopened in 1899. Dreyfus was reconvicted but later pardoned and publicly exonerated in 1906. Dreyfus went on to serve his country in World War I. In 1917, notorious World War I spy Mata Hari was executed as a German spy by a French firing squad. In 1964, it was announced that Nikita Khrushchev had been removed from his position as Premier and Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. In 1990, on this day, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to ease Cold War tensions and reform the Soviet Union's communist government. In 2003, China launched its first manned space mission. The brief mission made China the third nation to launch a human being into space. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
This is VOA News.